You're listening to the Israel Connection on JAIR Community Radio, streaming over the internet at j-air.com.au. My name is David Schulberg, bringing you another episode of this weekly radio program that provides analysis and insight with important interviews and discussion about Israel. Eliza Lewin is the recently appointed President of US Affairs for the Combat Anti-Semitism Movement, CAM, where she leads strategic engagement with government, educational and civic institutions nationwide. She previously served as president of the Louis D. Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law, where she spearheaded landmark legal efforts protecting the civil rights of Jewish students and employees across the US. We examine the spate of anti-Semitism today with a particular focus on Australia and the emergence of virulent anti-Zionism, an especially insidious form of anti-Semitism. I'm welcoming Eliza Lewin to the Israel Connection. Welcome to the program, Eliza.
Hey, David, it's a pleasure to be here.
Now, please tell us, you are the president of US Affairs for the Combat Anti-Semitism Movement. A few months ago, I interviewed your public affairs officer, Natalie Sanandaji. You no doubt are in close collaboration. Please tell us a little bit about yourself so our audience is aware of what you do exactly.
So I actually joined CAM as their president of U.S. affairs about 7 weeks ago. I'm a lawyer. I'm a litigator by training. And prior to that, I spent the last 8 years as president of a nonprofit in the United States called the Louis D. Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law that uses legal tools to counter anti-Semitism. I also have a law firm, a law practice, together with my father, Nathan Lewin. And together, even before I had joined the Brandeis Center, my father and I have been involved in not just general civil litigation matters and constitutional law, religious liberty issues, but we handled several cases of significant impact, I would say, for the Jewish community. So, for example, we in the United States brought the first case on behalf of victims of terror under the American Anti-Terrorism Act, which was a case that actually exposed, this is back in 2000, we filed that case. It was the case that exposed the Hamas fundraising network in the United States and established a vehicle for victims of terror to collect civil damages from those groups that were providing material support for terror. My father and I also brought a case that was known as the Jerusalem Passport case, which was a case in the United States that went to the Supreme Court twice involving the right of an American citizen born in Jerusalem to have Israel listed as their place of birth on the U.S. passport, because up until the time that President Trump recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, the formal position of the United States was to treat Jerusalem as a city with no country, as a city that had, you would list Jerusalem, but they would not refer to it as being in Israel. And then we also handled a case, this is also when I was at the Brandeis Center, where we represented Avi Zinger, the manufacturer and distributor of Ben & Jerry's ice cream in Israel, to we brought his lawsuit against Unilever at the time to prevent the attempt by Ben & Jerry's to boycott Israel and to prevent the sale of Ben & Jerry's ice cream in Israel. And the result of that is that he was actually sold the Israel business and is able to continue manufacturing and selling the same authentic Ben & Jerry's ice cream using the Hebrew and the Arabic logos throughout Israel and the territories. So that's the nature of the work that I've done. And I've now come to the Combat Anti-Semitism Movement to kind of take that whole legal framing and that understanding of these issues and the issues of anti-Semitism, and to try and help utilize those tools by sharing the framing with all the different constituencies that CAM works with in the United States. Everyone from partner organizations in terms of Jewish groups, to Christian groups, to African-American groups, to then also elected officials everywhere from local level and law enforcement to state levels as well.
Your focus is on the US, but I think you are extremely aware of the Bondi terrorist attack and the aftermath. What is that telling us about anti-Semitism in your view?
Absolutely. What that's telling us about anti-Semitism is that if you don't address it, it doesn't go away, it escalates. And we've watched this over the years. The work that I've been doing, anti-Semitism did not start on October 7th. Anti-Semitism has been around and has been increasing over the years, and we saw it happening on the campuses. October 7th, it was as if this dry brush had been spread across campuses, not only in the United States, but abroad, outside the United States. And on October 7th, it's as if someone lit a match and it all went up in flames. The university administrators, we would try and explain to them, this is not something that you can just close your eyes and hope that it'll go away one day. If you fail to address it, it escalates. And so it may start with the biased attitudes, with the slurs, with the inappropriate jokes. But if you don't address the biased attitudes, then they rise to the actual shunning, marginalizing, discrimination. And if you don't address that, then you actually end up with the acts of violence, with the assaults, with the vandalism. And if you don't address that, you will end up with the attempted murder and murder. What happened in Bondi was horrific. It was sadly, though, for those who have been watching this continue to escalate, it was actually a foreseeable progression.
Yeah, in my mind, it was the kind of thing that I would have expected more to happen in the US rather than in Australia. That's what stunned me. It was shocking from that point of view.
Perhaps because we see gun violence as a problem in the United States, which they're much stricter, right? Gun control laws in Australia. So one might have thought that it would happen or be more likely to happen
Yes.
in America. At the same time, I think that what was allowed to happen in Australia was this failure to address the anti-Semitism that targets Jews on the basis of our identity as a people with a deep ancestral connection to Israel, right? There are those who want to believe that anti-Semitism is only when it targets Jews on the basis of their religious belief, their religious practice, if they dress or look Jewish, right? Or if it is what we kind of consider the traditional anti-Semitic stereotypes of Jewish power or the Nazi era anti-Semitism. But today's anti-Semitism frequently targets Jews on the basis of our identity as a people with this deep ancestral connection to the land of Israel. It says if you're one of those Jews that views yourself as somehow connected to Jews around the world contemporaneously and to Jews historically, and you somehow think that as a people, your people, the Jewish people, have this ancient connection to Israel, which would entitle them to self-determination as a people in some borders in that land, you are a persona non grata. You are to be treated as a pariah and worse. That is also anti-Semitism, because that is anti-Semitism that is not a debate about a political opinion. It's not a debate about the policies of the government of Israel. It's not a debate about the Arab-Israeli conflict. It is the vilification, the dehumanizing of Jews. It is an attempt to erase and deny the way Jews have defined what it means to be Jewish for millennia. And many people refuse to recognize that as anti-Semitism. That's the problem.
Well, I've told you that I was attending an anti-Zionism rally, which I went to yesterday afternoon, and it's been reported in our media as a bunch of ghouls who are taking the opportunity now. They're complaining that the Jews are politicizing this tragedy that took place just barely over a week ago. I'm shocked by what these events are expressing. They can't be stopped at the moment, but there are movements by our legislative authorities, to led by government, to try and make a lot of these protests not to go ahead as they have been for such a long time here, week after week after week. One of the central problems in this particular rally was that Jews were the people who were running the show yesterday. And that's what is particularly terrible. I came home though, and that night there was an organization or a group that has put together
Zoom event that I attended, which is inspired by the work of Movement Against Anti-Zionism, MAZ, as they're called by their acronym. What do you make of this capturing of Jewish voices by the anti-Zionism movement?
So I think that historically, this is not the first time in history that we have seen Jews divide, if you want to say, or have different opinions on this issue. I actually would suggest to you that the first time in Jewish history where you saw Jews shed this idea of Jewish peoplehood and the yearning of the Jewish people to return to Zion, so the cut off of this idea of the Jewish ancestral connection to Israel, was actually in 1789 in France, when the French Parliament debated whether or not the Declaration of Rights of Man should apply to Jews. It was the first time that Jews were offered equal rights, and they debated in the Parliament. I joke because I say it was never a question as to whether or not the Declaration of Rights of Man should apply to women. That was clearly a no. But the debate about whether or not it should apply to Jews was an extended debate. And they concluded that for Jews as individuals, they should give everything. As a people, nothing. Because how could you give citizenship to a Jew who might feel connected to a Jew in England or a Jew in Germany? And you had members of the French Jewish community who wrote letters to the Jewish community saying, don't blow this. This is our first chance at equal rights, full emancipation. You can make religion something private in your home, but we are Frenchmen and France is our Zion. And about 6 years later, the same thing happened before the Dutch Parliament, where you had the Dutch actually came up with an oath that they wanted the Jews to take. I so-and-so hereby declare that I do not belong to any other people, nor any part of any other people, but solely and only to the people of the Netherlands. And so you had even back then a community that said, you know what? We don't define our Jewishness by our Jewish peoplehood. We don't define our Jewishness by our ancestral connection or the connection of the Jewish people to the land of Israel. And what was interesting is that when Herzl comes along in the 1800s with his concept of political Zionism, right, he then is surprised that the Western Europeans are not the ones that immediately follow him. It's the Eastern European Jews who were never pressured to shed this part of how they define their Jewishness. And so his political Zionism resonated with the Eastern European Jews because for them, this was an expression of what it meant to them to be Jewish, to be part of the Jewish people and recognize that as a people with an ancestral connection to the land of Israel, the people who are indigenous to Judea, right? They have a right to self-determination in some borders of their ancestral homeland. That for them was how they defined what it meant to be Jewish. And so when I look today at these Jewish groups, I think, okay, you may not define your Jewishness that way, but you have no right to vilify or dehumanize or demonize the majority of Jews who today still do define our Jewishness as part of a people with an ancestral connection to the land of Israel. You have no right to tell me how to define what it means to be Jewish. And I have the full right to fully engage in society today with my full Jewish identity, including my pride and my history, my heritage, my people's history and heritage, and our ancestral connection to our ancient homeland.
So how much blame would you say can be apportioned to organizations like Jewish Voices for Peace? And I mentioned them because they're very similar to an organization called the Jewish Council of Australia that behave in a very similar fashion. And the movement I just mentioned, the anti-Zionism movement, which is a new movement that is developing here in this country. How much responsibility or accountability can be apportioned to them for a thing like the Bondi terror attack?
These groups end up giving cover to those who engage in the anti-Semitism but want to say it's not anti-Semitism, because they point to these groups, right, and they say, how can it be anti-Semitism? Look at what the Jews themselves are saying. And yet it is anti-Semitism, and the tool, quite frankly, that I think is the best tool to use to understand the difference, right? The challenge that we have today as a society is the challenge of recognizing the difference between a good faith political debate about the Arab-Israeli conflict on the one hand and the vilification of Jews on the other. And the best tool for that, to understand that distinction, is the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism. Because what the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism does is it says the legitimate political debate about Israel, that's what the IHRA definition calls criticism of Israel similar to that leveled against any other country. You want to criticize the policies of the government of Israel? You can go at it. That's not anti-Semitism. That's like what people do in terms of criticizing their own governments all the time. You look in Israel, you'll see half the country half the time is demonstrating, criticizing the policies of the government of Israel. They're not anti-Semitic. What is anti-Semitic is when you demonize, you know, dehumanize, you apply a double standard to Jews or to Israel as the Jewish collective, or you delegitimize Israel. Delegitimize has been understood to mean denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, either by suggesting Israel has no right to exist, by suggesting Israel's a racist endeavor. If you look at the denial of the Jewish people's right to self-determination, why is that not a political debate? It's because what it is really doing is saying, you Jews, you're not a people, and you have no history in this land. That's what it means to deny the Jewish people their right to self-determination. And that's what we actually see taking place today in university campuses, and as well as now it's extending, we see it in America, and you probably see it also in Australia, as young as kindergarten through 12 in the courses that are being taught. The courses that are being taught now in schools are essentially saying that every human being who ever lived in the Holy Land since creation is Palestinian. And they'll say that that even includes Jesus. And they will claim that, yes, there were Jews, there were Christians, there were Muslims in the Holy Land, but that those were just religious, faith-based identities, but that the cultural, ethnic identity of any person who lived there was a Palestinian. And they say that they know the difference between the Jew and the Zionist. They'll claim the Jew is somebody who recognizes Judaism as just a faith. The Zionist, they claim, is someone who they accuse of stealing Palestinian history and heritage and calling it Jewish. That's what they claim. And now they say if anyone pushes back against this narrative that says that everything in the Holy Land since creation was Palestinian, that is considered racist. That's considered anti-Palestinian racism. So if you say, wait a minute, I'm part of the Jewish people and my people lived in the land of Israel as a people, and those are my ancestors, you're now a racist because somehow you are, they accuse of erasing Palestinian history and heritage. This is an effort, as I say, to delegitimize Jews and our ancestral homeland by erasing and denying how Jews have defined what it means to be Jewish for centuries, for millennia, actually.
These nefarious organizations have been spreading these false narratives, but they're operating in an environment here in this country where they're able to speak freely. So what responsibility would you say that our state and federal governments have for the spate of anti-Semitism that they've been generating in this country?
You know, they have a responsibility to recognize the anti-Semitism and call it out at a minimum, and to establish clear rules and laws that when violated, perpetrators need to be held accountable. In the United States, obviously, we have different laws when it comes to protecting free speech. And people in America will always ask me about the difference between hate speech and protected speech. And in America, hate speech is most often protected speech. In America, it really has to cross the line into conduct. And it's only the conduct that can be punished. Sometimes there can be an enhancement if the conduct is motivated by bias. But in countries that recognize hate speech, it's essential that people recognize the hate speech that's targeting Jews and not accept this masquerade that suggests that the hate speech is somehow a good faith political debate. If what it really is doing is spreading blood libels about Jews, like for instance, the allegation that Israel is engaging in genocide, if you look at the legal definition of genocide, and if you understand October 7th, and if you understand what Israel has to do to protect its citizens and the extensive steps that Israel has taken to protect against the loss of innocent civilian lives, it's absurd and outrageous to suggest that what has taken place is a genocide. And yet that allegation continues to be put out there as today's modern blood libel, right? If you understand that demonizing Jews or Israel as the Jewish collective is the idea, if you can visualize that traditional anti-Semitic caricature of the evil, hook-nosed, bloodthirsty, conniving Jew, but instead of that being applied to individual Jews, it's applied to Israel as the Jewish collective, that's essentially what the genocide label is. It's suggesting that Israel as a Jewish collective is this bloodthirsty, conniving, evil entity. That's not a discussion or an analysis of, does this meet the legal definition of genocide? No. That's just about trying to hammer into people's head this idea that the Jew, the Zionist, Israel is evil. That's the idea.
Yeah, what gets me is that, I mean, free speech in the US is very strongly protected by your First Amendment. In this country, we don't. The consequence, though, is still in the US, the government has been clamping down much more strongly on anti-Semitism than we've seen in Australia. That's been brought out by the way the government has been acting rather poorly since the Bondi massacre, with a lot of criticism coming on the government. I've shared with you an article by Professor Gil Troy, who has suggested that the recognition of Palestine by our government and the media's implanting of that notion that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza has set the scene for these more egregious acts of anti-Semitism against Jews everywhere. I tend to believe that if we normalize the notion, for example, that Israel is committing genocide, and that pervades the minds of so many individuals, it's not too far from the threshold for them to take actions against Jews that they believe are actually in the process of condoning genocide.
You know, if you understand how anti-Semitism has historically worked, right? Anti-Semitism goes in waves. And so you can have societies where the Jews have appear to have gained acceptance, they have managed to be incorporated into that society, and then it appears almost on a dime, like it turns. And the society becomes unhealthy and looks for someone to blame for the difficulties. And it is always the Jew that becomes the scapegoat in the first instance, right? They talk about the Jew being the canary in the coal mine. But the Jew becomes the scapegoat and the Jew is blamed. And because it is at its core a conspiracy theory, it doesn't matter what the individual who's engaging in that anti-Semitic stereotyping and conspiracy theories, the conspiracy theories can be diametrically opposed. That's how you have the Jew being accused of being the communist and the capitalist, right? It's just whatever it is that you find your misfortune or you dislike, that Jew is to blame. And then what happens is, once the Jew is to blame, well, then the understanding is the Jew is what's standing between us and utopia. So we have to push the Jew out of acceptable society in order to get to that better world. And you see that time and again. If you think, for example, about the Yellow Star of David that the Nazis had the Jews wear, initially the idea was they pushed the Jews into the ghettos. You were not supposed to engage with that Jew wearing the Yellow Star. You didn't shop in their stores or use them as your doctors or your lawyers. You shunned them. You excluded them. And then it escalates, as we started this conversation, it escalates to worse, right? It escalates. And so what we see happening today is this vilification of the Jews. That was happening on campuses. There's a former Knesset member in Israel, Einat Wolf, who has called it the placard strategy, right? She talks about how for years we were seeing on the campuses, she says, these slogans that could be boiled down, and you would see them almost on the signs, to a basic equation that the Star of David equals the Zionists equals some evil concept. It started with apartheid, ethnic cleansing, now it's famine, genocide, whatever it is. Those concepts aren't offered to kind of start a discussion or the debate on campuses about, does it amount to apartheid? Does it amount, what's the legal definition of genocide? No, those were all just there to try and hammer into people's head, that Jew is a Zionist is evil. And then, as Einat says, after October 7th, we saw a new sign emerge, which was, let's keep our campus clean with the Star of David in the trash can, because that's the next step, right? You've vilified the Jew, you've dehumanized the Jew. Now we can push the Jew out of acceptable society. And as Erwin Kotler, right, who is the international human rights lawyer, the former justice minister in Canada, and their first special envoy from Canada on combating anti-Semitism, he explained, if traditional anti-Semitism sought to deny individual Jews their place in society, this newer form of anti-Semitism seeks to do that not to the individual Jew, but rather to the Jewish collective, to the Jewish nation state of Israel. It seeks to deny it its place in the society of nations. There's no other country that's told that it has no right to exist. Suddenly, what's your answer? This concept that what stands between the world and utopia is the Jewish state. They don't say this about any other country in the world, no matter how horrific their conduct is, whether it could be North Korea, Iran, Russia, China. No, those countries, nobody talks about trying to push them out of the Society of Nations, deny them the right to exist. Only the Jewish state is told you have no right to exist, and they seek to deny it its place in the Society of Nations. That's today's anti-Semitism, and it's time for the world to recognize it for what it is, which is anti-Semitic Jew hatred, as opposed to some legitimate political debate.
We've been alluding to parallels to what has happened in history, Aliza, and I'm going back to these anti-Zionist Jews. They're the ones who are saying that if we get rid of Zionism, then all the world's problems will be solved. I mean, isn't this the same kind of delusional thinking that pervaded the minds of Jews in Germany pre-World War II, that thought if they became like normal German citizens, that Jews would be safe and sound?
Yes, they are very sadly mistaken. They think that this will protect them, and it will not protect them. Yes, I agree with you. I agree with you. The answer is not to try and shed Zionism. The answer is to actually be more boldly, proudly, outwardly, loudly Jewish, and to take pride very openly in our peoplehood and in our history and in our ancestry, and to demand that we be treated with the same respect and given the same opportunities without having to shed or disavow who we are.
You've been listening to Aliza Lewin, the recently appointed president of U.S. Affairs for the Combat Anti-Semitism Movement, where she leads strategic engagement with government, educational, and civic institutions nationwide. Liz Hirsch Naftali is the author of Saving Abigail, the true story of the abduction and rescue of a 3-year-old hostage, which chronicles the harrowing ordeal her great-niece endured after being orphaned and taken hostage in Gaza for 51 days. The unimaginable tragedy struck her family on October the 7th, 2023, when her niece and her nephew were murdered in front of their 3 young children in Kfar Aza. Liz's commitment as a hostage advocate and humanitarian began in those agonizing hours and grew more impactful from her strenuous efforts to see all the hostages freed from the clutches of Hamas. You've spoken about this issue of Abigail, your grandniece, on many occasions, no doubt. You're the author of Saving Abigail, the true story of the abduction and rescue of a 3-year-old host. And I welcome you to the Israel Connection, Liz.
Thank you.
Just for those who are not aware of the story behind your niece, in just a few words, tell us what happened and where you are at today as regards this whole saga.
First, thank you for inviting me to join you. And my heart is with you and people in Australia. The terror of October 7th lives on within me and within so many of us. But what happened on Bondi Beach on the first night of Hanukkah is something that triggers back so many emotions in addition to the terror of what happened that day. And I just want to say that my thoughts and all the work I do and that so many of us are doing is also to support you in Australia. And so thank you for being a powerful voice in this world that we are living in. October 7th, I was in Israel. I was going back and forth to the safe room, as everybody was that morning. I had lived in Israel for many years and had a family all over the country, but I have a very beautiful family living along the border of Gaza in Kfar Aza kibbutz. That morning, when I started to hear that something was happening along the border, I started to call my sister-in-law, my niece, and nobody living in Kfar Aza was going to answer the phone that morning. But I didn't know it at the time, what was going on. And I called my sister-in-law, said to her, what's going on? The first thing she said was that my niece Madar, her husband Roi, and their three-year-old baby girl Abigail had been murdered that morning, just about an hour before, by Hamas terrorists in their home in Kfar Aza. We learned about this because they had three children. Abigail was three, Amalia six, and Michael nine. And Michael and Amalia, 6 and 9 years old, were locked in a closet in a cupboard in their safe room in their house where their mother's body was laying next to them dead. The two children told us what happened to them that morning. They were in their house and the terrorists came in, and my niece was putting the three kids in their safe room and she was murdered by these terrorists in front of these three children. Her husband, who was a photojournalist, Roi, had gone outside. He took photos for Ynet, and he had done this on many occasions. As we know, missiles came into Israel from Gaza, and he had gone out to take photos. But this morning, he realized it wasn't what we would call a normal missile attack, which was one or two missiles, but it was an invasion. And he actually captured terrorists paragliding into their kibbutz that morning. But he ran back, and he went to find these three children running outside after their mother had been murdered. And he picked up little Abigail. They all started to run, and then he was murdered by the terrorists. And Michael and Amalia saw Abigail in his arms. And when he was murdered, they thought that she had been murdered also. And then they ran home, locked themselves in their closet. And that's where they spent 14 hours that day before they were rescued.
The protests have been running for 733 consecutive days in Hostages Square that came to an end as a ceasefire deal was announced 2 months ago, which has seen the return now of all the hostages bar one, with just the body of one deceased hostage, Ran Gvili, remaining in Gaza. One of Israel's three demands in its war in Gaza, the release of all the hostages, has been achieved. Now, your grandniece, Abigail, was released less than 2 months after October the 7th. So why is it so important for people today to be listening in particular to Abigail's story?
Abigail's story, for me, is a story that is very personal, and yet this is a story that reflects over 1,200 people murdered that day, her parents. I'm an American. Her mother, American, was murdered, one of over 47 Americans murdered that morning. Abigail was one of 35 children under the age of 18 that were kidnapped and stolen into Gaza that morning. For myself and for so many of us, that this is a story of we don't give up. We are resilient. We fight. We keep fighting for every life. And as you said, we're still fighting for the deceased body of Ran Gvili, who was kidnapped that morning after saving many lives. That's, I believe, who we are as Jewish people. And I believe that is who we should be as all humans, which is fighting for life. So Abigail's story and why I believe it is an important one is, yes, it's important for the Jewish community. And I've traveled the world with this book, Saving Abigail, because I want people to know what happened to my family that morning and to Abigail and her brother and sister and other relatives that were also hiding, fighting and saving, fighting for their lives for over 24 hours that morning. But I think that it's really a story that we can share with people who are not part of the Jewish community or that are doubters or don't know the facts. Because when you talk about a three-year-old child who's witnessed the murder of her parents and then is stolen into Gaza, it is a story that resonates with people, Jewish and not, about the terror and the horror of what happened that morning.
I think Hamas is aware of the way in which we Jews treat our lives as being so precious, and they have taken advantage of that, haven't they, in this war against Israel. If we go back to what happened with Gilad Shalit and his release, and how Israel saw his life as being of such great value, and in return gave over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners in return for him. This comes back to bite us, doesn't it, Liz, in a sense?
Well, look, the part that I keep going on is I want to talk about who we are as Jews and who we are as people. I don't understand how any human being could come in and murder children. They murdered and burned and killed children that morning. How any group could come in and rape and mutilate and then steal dead bodies in addition to live ones and take them as hostages. I don't understand how that works. But what I do understand is that the majority of people in Australia, the people in America, all over the world are good people, the majority. And so I talk to them and I do say, I don't understand. But I also understand that Israel needs to be strong and to survive. It's in a neighborhood of the world that is tough and rough. But I also want people to understand two things from this moment that I can speak clearly to. One, I know what it means to be Jewish and what it means to save lives. I know from the beginning of this hostage ordeal that while I and many other hostage families called for the release of Abigail and all the hostages and an end to the fighting, we also were calling for the support and the humanitarian aid for the children and women living in Gaza, because to us, we understood that this was about the hostages being released, but it was also about how do we as humans make sure that we are taking care of other people. But what I will also say, in addition to what you said about the disregard for human life, is that they were able to get people to believe them. They were able to get people to believe, even after seeing GoPro cameras of fellow terrorists stealing, killing, abusing bodies, they were still being able to get the hearts of people around the world to support them. When I speak to you today, my goal and my continuing goal, and I believe all of our goal, is not only to tell the truth of October 7th, but also to talk about the resilience and how we have been in this process of trying to fight for life. And we have a lot of allies. And that is who I want to talk about when I speak, which are people who are Jewish, Christian, Muslim, and from all over the world that have actually come together and spoken out against the terrorists, spoken out against the terrorists that perpetrated the murder of all those beautiful people on Bondi Beach. There are more of us. When you talk about it, like, I can't get into that mindset, but what I can do is talk about that there are more of us that we have to work together to keep pushing for a resolution of security and safety for the Jewish people, for Israel, but for all of humanity.
So for you, it's crucial that we keep telling the stories of those who have been murdered and those who have returned home. And you say that we need to make sure that it's safe for the children of Israel, the children of the region, and the children of the world. Now, that's a very broad brush statement. So you've been a hostage advocate up to this point of time. So you see your role now as changing to be an advocate of a different kind.
You know, we as Jews talk about tikkun olam. We take care of the world. We've never said tikkun Yehudim. We don't say take care of Jews. And I know that before October 7th, I grew up in a family that was always about how do we take care of the world? How do we do better? And most of it was through Jewish organizations in America where I grew up. But it was the Jewish Family Service where we were making sure that Jews were taken care of socially and in LA and given food, but we were also providing food for families and people that were not Jewish. What I've learned is that in this moment, we need to tell our stories. And I believe that we have not done that well as the Jewish people. We've been doing good things and we have been humble and trying to be respectful. But at this point, I think that one of the things, the messages that we've missed is telling the world who we are as people, tikkun olam. And so I feel like my role now is, yes, to keep telling the stories of October 7th, because if we don't, then they become, people can change the stories, they can change history. But for my niece and her husband who were murdered, I will keep being a voice so that their death, so their murder will not be in vain, but it will be used for a future and for a better world for Abigail and yes, all the children. Because at the end of the day, there is no child. When Abigail was taken, people would look at me and say, just like you did, how could they do this to a child? And so, yes, there are people that can do this to a child, and they are doing it. But it is upon all of us to find that higher voice and to find that higher level of talking about what it is to fight for Abigail and for all these children. Yes, it's about fighting against anti-Semitism. It's about fighting against hate, but it's also about telling the truth. And for me, that truth is, what is the truth of how it happened in Australia on the first night of Hanukkah? And that is because there was so much hate that was being able to be perpetrated in the world and in Australia. You know, I was in Australia a few months ago, And one of the things I heard in my time in Sydney and in Melbourne, I spoke with students, I spoke with Jews, non-Jews, people of all ages, races, was that even the non-Jews saw that the Jews were in danger. Even the non-Jews were speaking up, that were sitting there saying this anti-Semitism is being perpetuated and the government isn't standing up for these people. And these people are feeling unsafe and they are unsafe on the streets. When you hear something like that, and this was before what happened a week ago, but when you hear that, I think it is upon all of us to fight and to be supportive, because whether we live in Australia or in America or anywhere in the world, it is to make sure that those voices of hate, do not get to be the last word. I know that right now, especially where you're coming from, and I've heard podcasts and I've been reaching out to people in your country, there is so much pain. But you also have so many people in the world that are there supporting you, Jews and non-Jews. And that is because we're telling stories. And you will be telling the stories of all these families and all these people, a little girl, a 10-year-old little girl, people who are Holocaust survivors that then were gunned down and murdered on their streets in a country where they came for safety and security and lived as good citizens. Those are the stories we need to tell. And I believe it is upon all of us. And it is for me, sort of what I would say like is a calling now, which is to keep telling that truth, because that truth has to be sent to everywhere across the world. And it is a truth that I believe will bring more people on our side and understanding what we're fighting for.
Do you think that the issue of the hostages that were held by Hamas and Islamic Jihad could have been better handled by Israeli authorities?
I'll put on the side of, I'm not a politician. I'm not a military expert. I'm not an intelligence expert. I know that those people that were stolen on October 7th could have come back. And people will argue with me and saying terrorism and Hamas, but there were opportunities. And I believe that they were missed opportunities. And yes, we had to give in to terrorists. But to save those lives, what I believe was the most important thing was to do everything to bring back a child. And look, you and I both know that there were opportunities early on that were denied. But we also know there were opportunities that people in the Israeli Knesset voted against, leaders that are still there today, that voted against deals that would have brought Abigail and women and children home much, much earlier than 51 days when Abigail was finally released. People always ask me, is the Israeli government doing enough? Was Prime Minister Netanyahu doing enough? And for all those months that I was out there, and even after Abigail was released, to this day, it is still something that is so important to bring home hostages. I would say, until all the hostages are home, the Israeli government has not done enough. And look, I love Israel. I want Israel to be safe and secure. But what I also know in this moment as we speak, we do need an investigation. We need an independent investigation to find out why Abigail's family was not protected. My niece and her husband spent 28 hours in a safe room with three children, a neighbor, and her infant one-month-old child. 28 hours cowering in fear. We know the story of the Nova Festival, young people dancing. We know so many things. And we also know who Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and what terror, radical terrorism is. But what I also know is that we need to know how it was they were not protected in a country that promised to protect them. This is a complicated story. But what I also believe is that for us to go forward, we do need to know where we failed in the government of Israel so it does not happen again. I go back to, if we do an independent investigation and we learn who was responsible, where the failures were, then also we are doing what we need to do, which is to make sure that Israel will continue to be safe and strong. I'll just add, I wrote this op-ed recently, which talks about if you really love a nation, you're willing to go and fight for what it is. And that is to know the truth of where we failed. And so right now, I believe your question started with, could there have been opportunities and things done to bring home hostages earlier? And yes, there are. We could go into the nitty gritties and we don't have that time today, but there were opportunities and there were times when there was a friction between, do you get rid of Hamas or do you bring home the hostages? And for me, it was always, you bring home the hostages. Their lives are every day in danger. And we saw people whose lives were taken and lost in those days that should have been brought home, because Hamas is a terror organization and they have to be eradicated. But that was something that we knew would take longer. And that wasn't something that was specifically about saving our Jewish lives. It goes back to your question in the beginning, or your statement of the value that we hold for each independent life. I do think there were missed opportunities, and what I would hope is that there will be an independent investigation to know what the failures were, to review what happened over 2 years of how we did not get these people back to save more lives. But that would be so that the future of Israel will be safer and stronger.
You've been listening to Liz Hirsch Naftali, the author of Saving Abigail, the true story of the abduction and rescue of a 3-year-old hostage. In 1948, Stan Andrews left a comfortable post-war life in Los Angeles to travel to the war-torn Middle East, where a four-front Arab invasion threatened to destroy the newly declared State of Israel. There he joined the Israeli Air Force and became one of its first fighter pilots. Andrews was an unexpected volunteer for the fight for a Jewish state. He was many things: an artist, writer, assimilated Jew, ladies' man, pilot, and combat veteran of the Pacific War. He had previously been aloof from the struggle for Jewish independence, but found himself so roused by the anti-Semitism of the 1940s in America that he decided to go to Israel and risk everything. I spoke with Jeffrey Weiss, the author of Fighting Back, the story of Stan Andrews, a Jewish hero who has become the stuff of legend. I'm especially delighted to welcome back Jeff Weiss to the Israel Connection. A few months ago, we had an interview where you were in a different part of the world talking about Stickers of Meaning, which is an initiative that you were working with at the time.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be back.
We're talking this time about your book that is about a very special person, Stan Andrews, and the birth of the Israeli Air Force, titled Fighting Back. How did you and your brother Craig decide that you wanted to tell this story?
Back in 1995, we decided to write a book about the Americans who in 1948 came to Israel to fight in the War of Independence, made their contributions across all of the different branches of the Israel Defense Forces, but especially in the Air Force. And our goal was to have that book come out by 1998, the 50th anniversary of the founding of the state, which we were able to do. In the course of that research, we came across Stan Andrews' particular story, and we're really hugely drawn to him and the things that he did, the kind of person that he was, and resolved that after we finished that book, we would turn to Stan and to tell his story, which took considerably longer than we had expected. But it really was a wonderful labor of love that we've just now completed in paperback just a few months ago.
Well, I've enjoyed reading it. It's an extraordinary story of a Jewish hero, without any question. Tell us, please, what were the major campaigns that Stan took part in during Israel's War of Independence?
He took part briefly in basically the battle for Latrun very early in the war, and then became essentially a liaison between the Israeli Air Force and UN truce inspectors who were trying to keep Israel from bringing in new weapons and military age men. And so his mission essentially was to try to obscure Israel's arms smuggling during that period. And then he took part in a major campaign in the south to essentially liberate the Negev from its occupation by Egyptian forces.
Yeah, that was in connection with what was the isolation belt, is that right?
That's correct.
So, remove.
That's correct. The Egyptians had established what came to be known as the isolation belt, which separated Israel's southernmost forces from Israeli communities that were on the other side of the isolation belt and could only be resupplied from the air. And so Israel needed to break through the isolation belt to be able to reach those communities by land. And in fact, Israel was able to do that.
Just prior to this, Stan had been grounded after one of the missions he undertook, and I think that he preferred to be sitting in an airplane than working on the ground, liaising with the United Nations and keeping information from them, didn't he?
He did. It was one of the peculiarities of the War of Independence. The Israel Defense Forces then was not the professional Israel Defense Forces or Israeli Air Force of today. Since most of the pilots were English-speaking, there was a South African volunteer who was a psychologist with no prior experience dealing with airmen, and they put him in as the official psychologist for the Israeli Air Force. And he had a practice of simply grounding everybody who'd been involved in an accident. And in Stan's case, it was an accident at the controls of a plane that was notoriously prone to accidents. It was a Messerschmitt that had terrible flying characteristics. In Stan's case, he wasn't prepared to simply accept being grounded, and without authorization went back up in the air and on a number of missions in connection with that campaign in the South.
Well, in his relationship with Israelis, well, who were to become Israelis at the time, he didn't think that they were very competent in the way they went about their work, did he? He had some reservations about the way the whole show was being run.
Well, I think it was complicated because Israelis were in positions of command for the most part, and they were commanding over volunteers like Stan, who actually were professional, well-trained soldiers and airmen. And their commanders were considerably less accomplished, less experienced. And so that, to Stan and to a number of the other volunteers, was a source of frustration. But at the same time, he actually worked closely with a number of Israelis who later went on to positions of huge prominence, and for whom he developed great respect, like Azar Weitzman, Yitzhak Rabin, future head of the Mossad, and a number of others. You know, I think his opinions varied depending on who in particular he was dealing with, but I think within the Air Force, he was frustrated that the commanders were not at the same level as the men who were flying under them.
In your book, you express some criticism of the Israeli Air Force's actions, that they had a lack of preparedness in dealing with the special needs of these foreign fighters that had come to fight for Israel in the War of Independence. And there was a letter that Stan's older sister, Esther, sent to the Israeli authorities after his disappearance in a bombing mission, which expressed just that very feeling.
I think the challenge was that it was, in every possible way, the IDF was building itself at the same time that it was fighting a war. And I think foreign volunteers whose families were in other countries presented a special challenge, especially when one of them was killed or went missing. And they were not adept at that time of providing appropriate notification, communication with the families. And in the case of Stan's family, I think in particular, really did a poor job of communicating. And in the end, did a very poor job of returning to the family Stan's possessions. So that became a source of immense frustration to his sister, Esther, who I interviewed kind of at the outset of our research on this book. And she still, at the same time, was both immensely proud of her brother and what he did, and had a deep love for Israel, but also at the same time still had some bitterness over the way that she felt the family had not been treated properly.
Well, he kept a lot of secrecy about the fact that he had gone to fight in the War of Independence, and he also had changed his name. He was originally Stan Anneckstein, but that the reason he changed his name was to disguise the fact that he was Jewish, wasn't it?
Correct. He changed his name after high school, before college, from Andrews to Anneckstein, and did it with an eye toward entering the U.S. Army Air Corps and wanted to be trained as a pilot, and was concerned that with an obviously Jewish name, he might be kept from pilot training, given the extensive anti-Semitism that was then present in the U.S. in the 1940s. In going to Israel, he did what a number of the other volunteers did as well, which we learned during our research for the first book. A lot of them concealed from their families what they were doing, did not tell their families that they were going to Israel or that they were going to Israel to fight in a war. These were all veterans. They'd all subjected their families to immense pressure and stress during the Second World War. And in Stan's case in particular, he felt his parents had really aged when he was in the Pacific and did not want to burden them with news of what he was doing.
The research that you have put into this book, I find absolutely extraordinary, Jeff, and it's a delight to read those final chapters where you reveal some of the fortuitous events that enabled you to dig deep into Stan Andrews' story. Tell us how catching up with Joseph Jacobson, who had been a classmate with Stan during high school and college, led to a big breakthrough for you in revealing the story of Stan.
Yeah, that was amazing. For me, I thought after we finished the first book, it would be very easy to quickly find his family. I had a sense that he had created a lot of materials when he was in Israel. I figured they would have it all in some footlocker and we'd be off to the races. But I hadn't counted on the fact that the family did not stay in touch with the community of veterans. His last name, Andrews, was totally non-searchable in an efficient way on the internet. Basically, for years, just couldn't figure out a way to kind of move the research forward. And then a friend of mine suggested writing a letter to the editor of a New Jersey Jewish newspaper, because one rumor that I had heard was that Stan was from New Jersey, which in the end wasn't actually true. So I wrote the letter asking for information, anybody who knew Stan. And Mr. Jacobson responded and knew him in high school, knew him in college, and knew about the name change, and actually sent me copies of pages from those 2 yearbooks. And that really unlocked everything, because the name Anikstein is quite unusual, quite searchable. And within a matter of weeks, I had located his sister, sister-in-law, and a number of close friends. And that really got everything kicked off. But that was about 7 years after finishing the first book. So
Yeah, it's a
really did
great
take me.
piece of detective work in all of that, I would say. I want to allude to a slogan that's in your book, Hatovim Latayas, meaning best for flying, which Israel's commander of the Air Force, Ezra Weitzman, embellished to Hatovim Latayas for Hatovot Latayasim, which means the best men for flying and the best women for the pilots. Now, I find this particular statement quite intriguing. And you said in the book that that would have made Stan Andrews smile. It made me smile as well, because I wouldn't have thought that at that stage in the late 40s, in the War of Independence, that there would have been any female pilots in the Israeli emerging Air Force. Do you want to tell us what you know about how female pilots eventually did start to fly in the Israeli Air Force, and the fact that the policy was stopped for decades before Israeli women were allowed again to fly in Israeli aircraft?
Well, actually, what Weitzman meant by that was not—he was not referring to female pilots. He was referring to single women. He was referring to basically the social currency that
Well, it was almost, you
that
consider
pilot.
a. You could say it was a sexist remark, was
It was a sexist remark. It
it?
was basically that that pilots, the only fighter pilots and the only fighter squadron during a war, they were very desired and very admired by women, or so at least Azer thought. There was at least one female pilot in the War of Independence. I think her last name was Levertov, and she was actually killed during the war. In general, women served in combat during the War of Independence, and that basically more or less came to an end for 4 decades. In the case of the Air Force, there was a lawsuit, I believe in the 1990s, by someone whose last name was Miller, I believe, originally from Seattle.
Alice Miller.
Correct.
I've done a bit of research on this.
And that caused the Air Force to open fighter pilot training to women. And there are now, and I've met at least one, there are now female fighter pilots in the Israeli Air Force. In fact, I heard a statistic a few years ago that there are more Israeli women F-16 pilots than there are Saudi Arabian women who are licensed to drive a car. So Israel's come quite a way since then in terms of integrating women into all branches of the IDF.
The Israeli Air Force had closed flight training to women in the mid-50s, and that policy remained in effect until it came to be a landmark Israeli Supreme Court ruling in 1995, following a petition by the civilian pilot and aeronautical engineer Alice Miller. The first female pilot, according to my research, was Yael Rom, who earned her wings in 1951. So I need to do some more checking as to whether there was a female pilot involved in the War of Independence. You
I
were
think her
saying
last
that a
name
minute
was, I think it
ago.
was like Zahava Levertov. I've got her book somewhere on my shelf. If you look, you'll find some things about her. I think her plane crash landed somewhere in the south, and she and others on the plane were murdered. But yeah, she was the one in particular that comes to mind from that period. But other than her, I don't believe there are other female pilots. In general, there were very, very few Israeli pilots in the Air Force in the War of Independence, because they hadn't had time to train on combat aircraft. So you had a small number who'd served in the RAF, like Aharon Remez, who was the first commander of the Air Force, Ezer Weitzman himself, Modi Alon. All of them had served in the RAF, but there were very few who had accomplished that.
But they had a limited number of planes to fly in any case.
That's correct, especially at the beginning of the war. They started not on day one, but a week to 10 days in with four Messerschmitts, and promptly lost, I think, two of them on the first mission. They were really very deficient planes. That was the plane that Stan had his accident in. And it wasn't until later that they got a healthier supply of both Messerschmitts, then ultimately Spitfires, a few P-51 Mustangs, and became a much more effective fighting force.
You've been listening to Jeffrey Weiss, the co-author of Fighting Back, the story of Stan Andrews, a Jewish fighter pilot who flew missions during Israel's War of Independence.
You've been listening to the first part of this week's offering from the Israel Connection. Stay tuned, there is another episode of this program to follow.
In the second hour of the Israel Connection today, you'll hear once again last week's episode that featured the Bondi terror attack. I'd like to thank 2000 and others for supporting my program on the station. In today's show, you'll first hear from the envoy against anti-Semitism, Gillian Siegel, then some analysis of the ABC's coverage of the Bondi massacre, followed by a conversation with Sarah Brown, the regional director for the American Jewish Committee in San Diego. And finally, artist Nina Sanadze delivers a stunning condemnation of our government over its handling of the issue of anti-Semitism, with the haunting melody from Australia's emblematic Waltzing Matilda behind it to remind us of the 10-year-old girl Matilda who was killed at Bondi. Australia has experienced one of its deadliest mass shootings in its history on Sunday, when two gunmen opened fire on the first night of Hanukkah at Bondi in Sydney. 16 people are dead, including one of the attackers. At least 38 people were injured, including two police officers. In a moment, I will be speaking with Gillian Siegel, the envoy appointed by the Australian government to combat anti-Semitism. In our conversation which follows, we will talk about the spate of anti-Semitism in Australian society today and what can be done to address it. In particular, we will probe the work that she has been doing, consider the report that Gillian has produced, and discover what she is trying to achieve in her role as the envoy to combat anti-Semitism. Well, I can perfectly appreciate that you have an awful lot on your plate right now. I'm grateful for the fact that you're actually speaking with me on the Israel Connection.
Absolutely.
Do you remember when we spoke last in 2016?
Do you know, I don't. Please remind me. But my goodness, weren't they different days?
You were the New South Wales chair of the Australia-Israel Chamber of Commerce.
Okay, it was with that hat on. Okay.
And you were.
Do you know that very sadly, tragically, but hopefully not tragically, I suppose, just very sadly, one of my fellow directors of the AICC New South Wales from those days was badly injured on Sunday night. She's in hospital, very, very unwell, but hopefully will recover.
Yes, it is absolutely terrible. Absolutely terrible. The interview we're doing now was arranged before the massacre that took place at Bondi Beach on the first night of Hanukkah. How has this horrendous event changed your feelings about your role as our envoy to combat anti-Semitism? And has it changed your focus on what you see are the top priorities from your own perspective?
I think that's a very, very important question. I think it has clarified in my mind that this fight to push anti-Semitism to the absolute margins of our society is even more essential and important and urgent. And I think you could have no other conclusion other than that from Sunday's events, that what we all recognised was growing anti-Semitism. Sunday crystallised the fact that it is absolutely so dangerous for the Jewish community, so dangerous for the general community in terms of this being the country that we thought it was, that we have to act with great resolve and urgency to fight anti-Semitism. It's rather like when we think about a war analogy of fighting in the hills and fighting on the beaches and fighting everywhere. It is a multi-pronged thing that we have to do. And that is what's outlined in the plan that I handed down, that the plan considered where anti-Semitism was in our society and where we needed to tackle it on many fronts, that there's no one answer to it because it's become part of our almost culture. It's been normalized, not in Australia alone, but in other Western countries. There's been no doubt across the West foreign interference, but this is our responsibility now to fight. So it's increased my resolve and it's increased the urgency of it.
Our Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has been asked about the delayed implementation of your report that you announced more than 5 months ago. In his defense, Albanese has pointed out that he has introduced new laws against racial hatred, laws against doxing and the use of Nazi symbols, and that he has made financial contributions to social cohesion and security for the Jewish community. However, we hear many who believe that this is a distraction from the central focus of what is really necessary, the proper implementation of your report. No doubt you have had plenty of work on your plate. So what do you see as regards this delay in the acceptance of many of the details in your report?
Well, I think you're right to point out some of the things that have been done, and there are other things have been done that not necessarily in his list. I've done an enormous amount of work with universities, both in terms of new procedures and policies and education and various actions that many of them have taken. I can't say all of them, but many of them have taken to counter the hatred on campuses and to make Jewish students feel safe. And that is an area where I've recently announced the appointment of Professor Craven as my independent assessor, and he's doing a report card on every university as to how they are dealing with those recommendations that came out of the Joint Parliamentary Committee and also my recommendations. And we'll see how that's gone. Now, that has had strong support from government, where government has been necessary, like from the education minister and from the regulator. And indeed, the government put in place the student ombudsman, the National Student Ombudsman, to take complaints. So government has acted there. And it may not be something that the Prime Minister is so across because education minister's been the primary one. But there's an awful lot that we've been gearing up to do, like education about anti-Semitism. It's my very strong view that general education about race hatred cannot deal with anti-Semitism sufficiently. It's necessary for the country, and we need to understand what happened in history. So we need to study the Holocaust. But anti-Semitism education has to tackle where anti-Semitism comes from, the myths, the tropes, the fact that all these people can believe things about Jews that are not true, and that needs specific education. So we've worked on education modules and started to roll them out. For example, the Department of Home Affairs has put up the Immigration Department as the first place that this will be rolled out. But this is where Sunday's events need to galvanize us all. And I'm hoping that the Prime Minister appreciates this as well. We need to focus on this with increased vigor and roll out education throughout parts of the community, including the public sector, with urgency, with much greater focus, many more resources devoted to it, and tackle this underlying scourge. We also need additional law reform. You've pointed out the government has passed a whole raft of laws, both state and federal, but it's also clear that that's not enough. We do need to stop the hate speech. And as I said on Sunday night in a press statement, I'm sure you've seen, that I think hate words, hate speech leads to hate action. We saw that in Germany in the 30s. We've seen it in other places. People need to not be bombarded by hate speech, which says kill the Jews, globalize the Intifada. All of that is completely antithetical to Australian values, and we need to make that clear through our laws and through our judicial system. I'm hoping that the government will work with me in relation to further law reform, education, as I've said, throughout a community, but public sector and parts of community like the health system, the arts sector, etc. And on other initiatives, we need to really look at migration issues. We need to look at social media, which has become a great vector for hate, and what further controls we can impose on social media. And we need to counter what's on social media through education, as I've said. So a lot of things in the plan and a lot of detail in the implementation of the plan. I am hoping the government will now be focused very much on a strong response and on implementation. Can I just say, no, I'm not just hoping. That sounds like something too vague. I am expecting it. Okay, it has to happen now, because that would be an appropriate response to this tragedy, and also to the necessity that the government, I'm sure, feels that we have to correct what has happened and rebind Australians together.
Yeah, well, that's the rhetoric we're hearing. I've heard Penny Wong speaking this morning on the ABC, saying almost nothing to questions that were put to her about concerns that have been expressed that the government has been not doing enough to deal with anti-Semitism. I've listened to Alex Ripchin from the Executive Council of Australian Jewry, who criticises the government that's claiming these things that it's been doing, which have nothing really to do with the propulsion that's expected to come from your report. These are just things that were happening before. When you talk about law reform, we've seen laws introduced in states and also federally, but can you tell me if there's been one single prosecution under any of the laws that have been introduced? When I spoke to Louis Waller yesterday, Professor Waller at the Hanukkah function, and I put that question to him, he refused to comment, but somebody next to him said that basically it's a big fat zero when it comes to the number of prosecutions that have been introduced.
No. Can I just correct you there? Because that is not true, okay? I can't give you the exact figure. We can do some research, but we've been generally following the prosecutions, and there have been prosecutions. I would say maybe there have been about 20 prosecutions in relation to the spate of anti-Semitic incidents that we saw last year, you know, graffiti and firebombing and so on, demonstrations where terrorist symbols have been displayed and so on. So there have been prosecutions, and people have gone to jail, but not for long periods of time. Many of these prosecutions have been in the magistrates' courts. Their jurisdiction doesn't extend to long jail periods. I think the maximum might be 2 years. We have seen prosecutions. We have seen 6 months or 9 months jail, etc. But I'm sure that I'm not unique in saying that that's probably not sending a sufficiently strong message to those who wish to behave in that way, that is not sufficient. And I think the government now needs to look at the way the law is working and make some changes to ensure that it reflects community standards. I've got a series of recommendations to make to the government. I have been in touch with them. I will be putting up a series of recommendations together with community organisations like the ECAJ. We have been liaising about what is the answer, because at the same time, we have to strike a balance, okay? We want that kind of behaviour stamped out. But we do live in a democracy, and we've got to understand that we support free speech and rights to assemble. But we need the guardrails. I've spoken about the guardrails, and there are guardrails between free speech and hate speech. Maybe they haven't been sufficiently strong or clear, and maybe the prosecutors have found it difficult to provide the relevant evidence, and we need to look at that. Because one of the things that I have spoken about to the government and to those considering law reform, and that has been looked at overseas, and, you know, we're not Robinson Crusoe. We have to look at what's happened overseas, because we've seen similar behaviour there. The impact of some of this, that the test is not just what they had in their mind, but what they did has had impact on our community. It's made people feel scared, intimidated, unable to carry on with their normal life. And community impact has got to be taken into account now and is a way to consider the seriousness of the offence. So I think there's room for considerable law reform, and I will be expecting the government to consider it very seriously, not push it down the road. But we've now seen enough prosecutions, 20 or so, as I say, in the different states and federally, maybe more. The new laws are operating, but perhaps not optimally. We need to refine them. And that's part of what I'm hoping to do. If the government comes out and does endorse the plan, it's a high-level plan, deliberately, because these areas have to be worked on with government and with community. And then the implementation needs to be expanded. And I am working on an implementation plan on the assumption that the government is absolutely committed to this. So I am with you. I'm expecting a very strong answer and response. very soon because it's necessary. I'm also expecting strong cooperation, assuming that happens, strong cooperation in its implementation with a renewed sense of urgency.
Well, there's a lot of anger and disbelief that it had to come to this for your report to be given serious consideration. We heard remarks from Alex Rifkin, who said that we had to wait for the Islamophobia envoy to write his report. Then we heard that it needed to go to the Human Rights Commission for a weighing up of both your report and his report, the report from the other envoy into Islamophobia. It has been an inordinate amount of delay can anybody can justify it.
No, I hadn't heard that both reports were being weighed up by the Human Rights Commission. I'm sorry, I don't know where Alex gets that from, but I hadn't heard that.
These were remarks that Jason Clare made at the back at the time.
No.
The Education that's Minister.
That's not true. He made remarks at the time that both reports would be considered together with a report from the Human Rights Commission,
yes.
Where they are doing some work. Or they've done an extensive survey at universities. He thought that it would be very useful information from their survey as to what hatreds and attitudes exist in universities as well. There might be other hatreds, I think was in his mind, as well as, of course, anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. And therefore, he was thinking that one could tackle it in a more holistic fashion. It was not that the Human Rights Commission was weighing up our two reports. They were doing their own piece of work. But I do think that, and yes, it's incredibly unfortunate, tragic, what can one say, that it had to come to this. And as I said on Sunday, we always expected that the hate that was on our streets and in our media, particularly social media, would result in some ongoing hateful action that went beyond graffiti. But I don't think anyone expected, no one could have expected the horror of Sunday. Where we are, in a sense, horrifically where we are, and I do expect Sunday to have been a huge wake-up call to the government and as it is to the general community. I mean, I don't know about you, but I've had the most enormous outpouring of support and embrace from everyone I have ever met in the community. That shows something about the Australian spirit of standing up for those who've been hurt. And that is now the opportunity for the government to come out very, very soon with a very strong statement of support and actions to follow. I mean, I'm not interested just in a statement, and I'm sure you wouldn't expect me to be, but it's reflective of what I hope will be a renewed energy, engagement, commitment, including resourcing, not to me, but to those who need to carry out some of the initiatives in the report.
You mentioned education as a very important factor that we need to consider, but education is a long-term proposition. You mentioned specifically Holocaust education. We've seen during the period since October the 7th, the growth of groups like Teachers and Students for Palestine that have gone into education settings and tried to propagate the message that they have, which is anti-Israel. In your report, Israel is scantly mentioned.
Not mentioned at all. I don't believe it's mentioned at all.
Yeah, well, it is mentioned once or twice. But my belief is that this huge spate of anti-Semitism that we've been experiencing has arisen from the antipathy towards Israel that is so widely manifest in so many parts of our society, in academia, in the media. Don't we need a feature of our education to be dealing with the Israel-Palestine conflict and so people can be properly informed of what the true nature of this conflict is actually about?
That is something to take on board. I mean, I agree with you. What modern anti-Semitism today is reflecting is this horseshoe. The hate on the right, the traditional hatred that has come out of the Holocaust, that was reflected in the Holocaust, if I could say, that same kind of right-wing hatred. And then we have a left-wing hatred, which conflates anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism. does not understand the Jewish people's connection to Israel and the fact that one can support Israel and feel that connection without necessarily supporting all its policies. And then the study of the Middle East as it's manifest in Gaza and with Hezbollah and the Houthis and all those areas of attack that Israel has suffered and had to engage in. That is a secondary issue. It's part of it. And I do not dispute that there will be many, many teachers who want to go into that space. But the important space is to understand that you cannot blame the Australian Jews for just existing, being part of the Australian society, and also being true to their faith and loving Israel. That degree of connection is part of being Jewish. Blaming the Jews for perceived injustices in Israel, right or wrong, that is part of anti-Semitism, and we need to understand that. So it's a multi-layered approach, David. We need to understand, you know, fundamental being a good person, you know, and we have lots of organizations that teach that, Courage to Care and Together for Humanity and others, where all faiths come together and want to teach people to be good people and upstanders. Then Holocaust education is necessary because we must learn from history. Okay, then specific anti-Semitism education is necessary because we have to understand the myths about Jews and we have to understand where their beliefs and connection to Israel comes from. So that's not a module about the wars of the Middle East, but it is the connection of Jews to Israel. And that is the trial that I'm proposing to roll out next year, with the support of UNESCO around the states of Australia. But that now needs to be accelerated. That's what we need. Where we go in a fuller understanding and debate about the Middle East is really not the main game. The main game is to understand anti-Semitism, the modern form of anti-Semitism, which has taken the form of anti-Zionism. That's my focus, and that's what I've made extremely clear in the work. And we've produced a module to be rolled out through the public sector to educate them about anti-Semitism. And the first people who have put up their hand are those in the immigration department, those who do visa processing. And you know, I think we have to recognize that progress is being made. It's obviously not enough, but that has taken a bit of time to get that agreed and to produce the resources to educate with support of the Holocaust Museum Alliance, headed up by the Sydney Jewish Museum in the case of this module. So, you know, that is what we've been working on. So there's been progress. It's not been nothing, but I don't resile from your criticism that it's not enough. And now we need to see it accelerated and strongly supported. And that is my expectation, but we have to wait and see. But I am expecting that soon.
It's been reported that the Prime Minister did not raise your six-month-old plan on combating anti-Semitism at an emergency post-Bondi massacre national cabinet meeting with state leaders, and he was actually forced to bring up this. He just introduced it with a pre-written press release, but it's apparent that he's been focusing more on gun law reform then what is the primary concern here about anti-Semitism? Do you not see it that way?
Well, obviously, I was not at National Cabinet, and I don't know what was discussed. If I might comment in two ways, and then I'm
but just. But you've been having meetings. You've been having meetings with the Prime Minister, hasn't he? Been what's the focus he's been having in those meetings?
I've had one meeting with him since Sunday. Obviously meetings before Sunday, but one meeting since Sunday. And obviously the meeting I've had with him is focused on anti-Semitism and my report.
Yes.
Okay. I have not been focused on gun control, and it's not my focus, although if it's an important focus for police, of course we will, as a country, need to look at gun control laws. We need many responses to the events of Sunday, but my focus is on what we're doing to fight anti-Semitism. It's become normalised, as we know, in our country, as in other Western countries, through a whole range of forces, including, I think, foreign forces. And the government did take action in relation to Iran. We have to recognize that when they were faced with that evidence, they did take strong action. an immediate action. But now we need to step up our domestic work in relation to anti-Semitism. If in addition we do gun control, that's fine, but it's by no means the answer to the underlying cause, which was anti-Semitism. So, David, I'm afraid I've got people knocking on my door. We've been going for about half an hour, and I probably need to go. Can we make one last question?
Yeah, I've got one. I really want to bring up the issue of the ABC, which the media hasn't been really discussed very much in this. And there was a woman who was interviewed by the ABC, and I'm going to play that little grab from her where she actually criticised the ABC when she was speaking directly to them. We've seen that you were interviewed on the ABC by Sarah Ferguson, who really gave you a hard time. I don't believe that I've given you such a hard time as she did.
No, not at all.
Senator Sarah Henderson's been leading a demand for an urgent Senate inquiry into the ABC, claiming the public broadcaster's editorial division has been allowed to run wild and is no longer fit for purpose as a taxpayer-funded source of trusted news and current affairs. What is going to be your focus on the ABC when you were questioned by Sarah Ferguson about specifics of dealing with the media? You gave no real concrete examples. I've got a heap of examples of where the ABC's systemic anti-Israel bias is plainly evident. What are you going to do to really hone in on this area?
It's an absolute specific matter called out in my plan. I think we do need to look at what has been the media reporting by the ABC and SBS, public broadcasters, public money, and to see if, like we've seen with the BBC, there's been systemic bias. I think that's a major piece of work that needs to be done. And, you know, I'd be happy to receive from you any specific list of examples, because it's certainly a piece of work that I think needs to happen, because they are very influential and they have a mandate to be balanced and fair and representative of all parts of community and to actually build a strong country. So we need to look at that. I agree completely. That doesn't mean that a commission of inquiry is the answer. I think we need systemic work in relation to it, but definitely on my radar.
Well, I hope it's given a lot of attention, because I believe that the media has been driving thoughts into the minds of people, which is what eventually leads to some people going off the deep end into the sorts of terrible actions that we perceive and happened right in front of our very eyes on Sunday.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Well, we know, as I said, hate words, propaganda, that all leads to action. So we have to tackle it at all levels. So thank you, David. Really
well,
appreciate it.
Let's look forward to action.
David, if there's no action, we will all be very focused on what should be done. But I believe there'll be action. We have to just respond to this tragedy with renewed determination to take action.
Well, I appreciate having the opportunity to speak to you in this time where you're under an enormous amount of pressure.
No, thank you. Thank you, David. And thank you for being very, very balanced and fair.
I've been speaking with Gillian Siegel, the envoy appointed by the Australian government to combat anti-Semitism. One small correction I'd like to make is that when I referred to Professor Louis Waller, I should have said Professor Ian Waller, who gave a special address yesterday in the Victorian Parliament for the occasion of Hanukkah. Let's listen now to the short interview that was done with a woman on the ABC, to which I referred in my conversation with Gillian Siegel.
How are we feeling? Is this what you wanted? Is this enough now? Will you listen to us? Albanese, Wong, will you listen to us? Will you actually do something? Will you actually... don't have to stand up and say anything, because we don't believe you anyway. And ABC, I've got to say, will you cut out the biased reporting? Mainstream media, we feel we've... Yeah, will you cut it out? Will you actually let us have a voice? Because we feel that part of the reason that the Jewish people have experienced such a massive change in Australia towards us. I mean, I'm Aussie, you know, but, and I'm not a religious Jewish girl, but a woman. But since October the 7th, since all the hatred that's been thrown at us, I started to wear my Magen David because I'm Jewish. And if you have something to say, you can say it to me. And ABC, please stop with the biased reporting.
Victoria, we are so sorry for what you are going through and what you have been through. And we really hope that your father recovers. I know all of us here, we are horrified by what has been going on. So thank you for joining us and sharing your story, Victoria.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, we are going to stay across, obviously, what is happening here at Bondi Beach.
On ABC Radio National this morning, Australia's Foreign Minister Penny Wong was interviewed by ABC presenter Mel Clark. The questions posed by the ABC presenter were sensible and reasonable, but Wong's responses were dreadfully hollow and indirect. You just need to listen to her weasel words to realise how appalling she is and how the government that she represents is failing miserably.
Authorities are now investigating the training and connections the Bondi gunman may have had both in Australia and overseas. Police have confirmed the father and son alleged killers travelled to the Philippines weeks before they killed 15 people at a Jewish community event on Sunday. A senior counter-terrorism official has told the ABC that the pair received military-style training on a southern island known for hosting terrorist groups. Penny Wong is the Minister for Foreign Affairs.
Good morning, Mel. Good to be with you.
With the benefit of hindsight, do you think this attack could have been prevented?
Well, look, the country is in shock and the country is in pain and the country is grieving, especially Jewish Australians. At the same time that we have felt so much pain, we've also seen the best of Australia, and we know we're stronger and all safer when we stand together, and that's what we must now do, to come together, to ensure we act with resolve, to protect all Australians and to protect in particular our Jewish community, and to confront at all levels, government, community, media, anti-Semitism.
I do want to come to some of those broader issues, but for specifically at looking at some of the information we now know about these two men. We know they travelled to a known terrorism hotspot in the southern Philippines and took part in a training camp. Is that the sort of activity by Australian citizens, something that Australian authorities or our intelligence partners should be able to detect?
Well, I know it has been confirmed that the attackers travelled to the Philippines prior to this attack. Obviously, as the New South Wales Police have said, their visit and why they were there, where they went and so on is part of the active investigation. So some of the matters that you're referring to are not matters that I can comment on at this point in the investigation, Mel.
Is there any further update then that you can give us following your conversation with your Philippines counterpart yesterday?
Well, look, one of the things I've been doing has been to engage with my foreign counterparts. We're grateful for their condolences and solidarity. And one of the counterparts I engaged with was Foreign Secretary Lazaro. We appreciate her condolences. You probably understand I can't go into all details of our discussion, but I can say that we, Australia and the Philippines, are long-standing partners on regional security and on related matters, and that will continue.
I appreciate there are limits to what you can say at this point, but we have heard from the FBI Director Kash Patel saying that the US is providing requested intelligence to Australia. Mm-hmm. We know that the US has a significant presence in the southern part of the Philippines. Would it be fair to presume that the US is offering assistance or coordination where required?
What I can say to Australians is our law enforcement and intelligence agencies are engaging with all relevant foreign counterparts in order to make sure we have the fullest investigation possible.
Minister, has the government done enough over the last 2 years to combat anti-Semitism in Australia?
Look, we know we have taken many actions, including criminalising hate speech. But what I would say to you is that we all understand we need to do more. We will dedicate every resource required to making sure Jewish Australians are safe and protected. But as Gillian Segal has said publicly at the anti-Semitism envoy, whom I spoke with on Sunday night, if we are to confront anti-Semitism fully, then the government needs to act, and so do does all of the community. And we need to draw inspiration from, I think, firstly, the principle that we are stronger and more united when we are united, and also from the example of Ahmed El Ahmed, you know, a Muslim Australian migrant who ran towards danger to save his fellow Australians. And that is the spirit all of us must bring to this.
Gillian Segal said yesterday that there should be a formal statement from the government about the implementation of her recommendations in her report that your government received in July. Likewise, your colleague Josh Burns told the ABC yesterday that he wants to see a timeline and an agenda around dealing with those matters. Will the government give a formal response and a commitment to all of the recommendations in that report?
I think the Prime Minister made clear yesterday he had met with Ms. Segal about her report, and what she has said publicly, and certainly that reflects her discussions with me, is that she recognises that whilst we have acted on and will continue to act on the implementation of the plan, that there is more to do. And we will work with her and all governments through National Cabinet to make sure we confront anti-Semitism. But as I said, it's something all of us must do. So government has our responsibility, and we accept that. But we all need to act.
So will there be a formal written response to the report?
Well, look, I'll leave that for the Prime Minister to discuss with Ms. Segal. I'm sure those discussions yesterday went to what the next steps are. But people should be in no doubt about our resolve, as the Prime Minister said on Sunday night. We are determined to eradicate anti-Semitism in our country, and we are determined to work to bring Australians together. I keep saying this, but it is true. We are stronger when we are more united. And there is much in our community that we can look to, you know, that gives us hope and inspiration, whether it's Ahmed El Ahmed or those who ran towards danger, or those who are rolling up their sleeves to donate blood, or the first responders who responded, some of whom were injured.
Yesterday, the former Prime Minister, John Howard, made some personal criticisms against you and the Prime Minister. He said the decision to recognise a Palestinian state was premature and needlessly provocative, and he questioned why you didn't visit areas of Israel most directly affected by Hamas's assault. What's your response to the former Prime Minister's criticisms?
Look, this is a time where we are grieving, and I offer my condolences to the Jewish Australians who have lost loved ones, to those. I offer my support to those who are recovering in hospital, and I'm not going to get into a political debate.
Is there anything you would do differently in hindsight over the last 2 years?
Look, I think people would have seen consistently the government, the Prime Minister, all ministers, including I, being very clear about the unacceptable anti-Semitism in our society. I've made that public statement many times. But as I said to you at the outset of this interview, we all have to do more, and I accept that.
Foreign Minister Penny Wong, thank you very much for joining me on Radio National Breakfast this morning.
Good to speak with you, Mel.
That's the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Penny Wong, there.
I have to say that I've had an extraordinary number of messages of sympathy from so many people whom I've interviewed over time. One of those came from Sarah Brown, who is the director of the American Jewish Committee Office in San Diego. Sarah Brown is a genocide scholar who has been a member of the International Association for Genocide Scholars for more than 10 years and was on its advisory board for 2 4-year terms. Let's listen to our discussion about the significance of the Bondi Massacre from her perspective.
How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing all right because I'm not directly affected. There are some people who are injured that I know of. And if you see my bulletin I put out today for my show, the picture is of one of those very people who is an international lawyer, Arsen Ostrovsky, an Australian who went to Israel as back in Australia now. I don't have direct contact with him, but I think his picture is an absolutely epic representation of what happened on Sunday.
It's awful.
There's been a lot of words that have been thrown around here. Did you have a chance to listen to our foreign minister's remarks?
So I heard about the first 5 to 6 minutes of it. And so I heard them saying, yes, we've done what we can to criminalize hate speech, but more could be done. It sounds like word soup, if I'm being, but here, I mean, I'm happy to comment on it if you want to.
Well, I find that, she didn't answer the first question about whether they could have done something to stop this terrible massacre that took place. I mean, there's a lot of antipathy towards her and to the Prime Minister. I'm going to have somebody else who's here who's put an exhibition on at a local gallery after October the 7th. She encourages performance artists and is a sculptor herself. That's Nina Sanadze. There's an incredible amount of anger, and I can see that the government is forced, obviously, to be making remarks like, we've got to do more. How could they not be saying that? But they've had a recommendation from the anti-Semitism envoy, Gillian Siegler, who I'm hoping to speak to. If I'm not speaking to her, I'll be speaking with her chief of staff, because she may be called into another government meeting, and I'm very sceptical of what these government meetings are achieving. They're trying to somehow wind their way through this morass and find a way to give the impression that they're actually taking proper action that is going to remediate the situation we're in. From a perspective of gun control, and this is something, of course, which crops up every time in the US. You're totally familiar with this. This is now seen to be a diversion from the real central focus that's needed here on anti-Semitism.
I understand folks who are concerned about gun control. I get that. I respect that. I understand that Australia made historic reforms after a horrific mass shooting in the 90s. But I do wish that the focus could be on addressing this scourge of anti-Semitism here and now. Yes, if you feel the need to implement those reforms, fine. But first things first, you need to address the poison, the virus that is infecting your society, in my opinion.
So when we spoke about this report that was put out by genocide scholars. And I would put the proposition that the fact that media and other organizations that around the traps have been pushing out a message that Israel has been committing genocide in Gaza, and no doubt that is getting into the minds of many people, and could be seen to be a driving force behind actions that we just saw, like the one at Bondi. No doubt, I think you might agree with the fact that this allowance of this continual accusation of which amounts to a blood libel against what Israel has been trying to achieve is something that there should have been more pushback against.
I agree with you. I similarly am concerned that misinformation and disinformation about the Israel-Hamas war and Israel's actions in the context of the Israel-Hamas war have become fuel for anti-Jewish sentiments, Jew hatred, anti-Semitism around the globe. And I also frustrates me to say this. We were not shocked, unfortunately, by the horrific, horrific events that just took place at Bondi Beach. We were not shocked. We were devastated, but we were not shocked because our CEO, Ted Deutsch, had traveled to Australia to stand in solidarity with the Jewish community there back in September and had numerous conversations saying, you need to address the hate rhetoric that is going unchecked all over Australia right now and the anti-Semitism that is going unchecked all over Australia right now. And unfortunately, what we're seeing, you know, meaningful action against anti-Semitism must be taken or we see the disastrous, violent results. Here we are today. It's awful. And I think that unfortunately, the misinformation, the disinformation, the normalization of this hyper-focus on Israel in the context of the Israel-Hamas war, that has led to a lot of folks who are looking at this content. They're looking at international organizations issuing statements that are so deeply biased and problematic, and it is justifying their hatred and eventual turn to violence and radicalization.
In the United States, do you feel that your organization is getting enough support from the authorities, from government, which differs from what we are seeing here in Australia?
It hurts my heart to say it because I wish it were better for Australian Jews, for our brothers and sisters in Australia. But I do feel that we do have a core base of support. So I can speak to some of what transpired on Sunday for me here in San Diego. That morning was devastating and awful. But I also want to point out that almost immediately, we heard from our local elected officials and our law enforcement officers and key figures who reached out to share their grief, to share their solidarity, and to also tell us what steps they were taking to ensure that Jewish institutions across the community were safe and secure and would be able to celebrate the first night of Hanukkah, knowing that they were every measure was being taken to ensure they could gather and gather safely. And so I was very grateful for that. At the same time, we reached out to our members of Congress, so our five local U.S. representatives and our two senators, to tell them that we were horrified by what had happened and we need assurances that at the federal level, they are going to continue to take every step possible to ensure that we don't get into a situation like this here in the United States. Right now, we're waiting for our special envoy on anti-Semitism to be confirmed. And so that's something that we ask. But we also ask community members, elected officials, and law enforcement to stand with the Australian Jewish people and to light a candle for Australia. And so I want to point out, too, that while, yes, words are not enough, those expressions of solidarity do create a groundswell, and they do signal to those who would capitalize on anti-Israel rhetoric and Jew hatred to normalize expressions like globalize the Intifada and other horrific hate speech. I think that they saw that and they realized this was not a time to push. They did not have a platform right now. It is different here, and I wish it were better for our brothers and sisters in Australia.
So your previous envoy, Deborah Lipstadt, has stepped down. That's why there's a vacancy at the moment, which hasn't yet been filled.
Correct. We are in fact waiting for that position to be filled. We're hopeful that that will be expedited, but we understand that that's with our federal government right now. We are also very big fans of Deborah Lipstadt here in across the United States in the Jewish community. I'm proud to say that she's actually coming to speak to our San Diego community as a keynote speaker of one of my organization's events that we're going to be hosting on April 19th of 2026. And so, David, I want to welcome you, invite you. If you want to come hop across the pond, you are more than welcome to join and hear from her directly.
Yeah, the pond is a little bit wider than ponds I'm normally able to hop across.
Still, you are welcome.
In your neighbor, Canada, they also have had an envoy to combat anti-Semitism, Deborah Lyons, who was a former ambassador to Israel. That position hasn't been filled since July after she stepped down.
Yeah, I know more about what's happening here in the U.S., but we have watched events transpire in Canada with growing concern. The envoy isn't, it's not a panacea. It's
exactly.
Not a silver bullet. It doesn't fix everything, But I do think it is a strong signal from the highest echelons of government that they are taking this seriously, that they want to take proactive steps to ensure that anti-Semitism is on its way down and is not allowed to continue to rise unchecked. And unfortunately, I think where there is that lag, where there are the dragging feet, where they're hesitating to fill a position, that to me is a worrisome indicator.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for speaking to me on Israel Connection and giving your views from the other side of the world as to what has transpired horribly here in Australia just a few days ago.
Yeah. Listen, thank you for having me. We are mourning with you. We are devastated with you. We stand with you right now for Jews all over Australia, and especially those who are hospitalized right now and recovering from the attacks in Bondi Beach. A refuah shalema to them. This has been horrific, but we will not, and this is something I feel very strongly about, we will not let them dim the light of Hanukkah. And so if anything, like, we're all going to light candles and make that light shine even brighter, because right now this is our best form of spiritual resistance.
Well, we really appreciate getting the empathy and sympathy from people like yourself. I've had other people that I've spoken to on my program that have sent me messages asking if I'm okay. When I'm in Melbourne, this all took place in Sydney remotely from where I am. It could happen. It could have happened in Melbourne. It could happen anywhere, as we know. People here are very afraid, and things need to change without any doubt whatsoever.
Yeah. You know, David, I was thinking about it. Here in San Diego County, we have a study from 2022, so the numbers might be a little different, but we have about 100,000 Jews in San Diego County alone. And my understanding is it's maybe around 120,000 or so across Australia.
Well, similar number.
Similar number. And we're so tight-knit here. And even though you're spread across this massive, wonderful continent, wonderful country, I just imagine it's a small community. It's a tight-knit community. And also we are part of a global Jewish family. And so one of us is hurting. All of us feel it.
That's absolutely the feeling. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much, David. I hope you stay well.
I've been speaking with Sarah Brown, the director of the American Jewish Committee Office in San Diego. Nina Sanadze is an amazing artist, a Jewish sculptor who lives in Melbourne and runs the Goldstone Gallery in the suburb of Collingwood. She has been running a unique exhibition in her gallery in commemoration of October the 7th. Following the Bondi massacre, Nina found it necessary to express how she was feeling following more than 2 years of anti-Semitic hate that has been festering in this country of Australia. One poignant aspect of the horrific Bondi terror attack is a 10-year-old girl named Matilda, who has been identified as one of the victims of Sunday's terror attack at Sydney's Bondi Beach. She had been named Matilda by her Ukrainian parents as a way of acknowledging their special link to this country of ours. As you hear Nina talking in the background, you'll be listening to an orchestra playing a version of Waltzing Matilda, which is in tribute to this 10-year-old girl who passed away so tragically at Bondi on Sunday. You're about to hear the words that Nina has put together to express her intense feelings about what we have been experiencing because of anti-Semitism and the abject failure of our government to properly address it.
A 12-year-old girl, Matilda, was just murdered on Bondi Beach in Sydney 2025. Her Jewish family survived the Holocaust by bullets in Ukraine in 1942, but not this. Most of my family perished in Holocaust by bullets too. Matilda's parents said, "We came here from Ukraine, and we named her Matilda because she was our firstborn in Australia. We thought Matilda was the most Australian name that could exist. So just remember her name. So I ask you, what will it take? Go to Canberra, go to Parliament House, go to the ABC, demand the Prime Minister Albanese resign now. Stop business as usual. Bring your families, stand up and refuse silence. This government has catastrophically failed to protect Jewish Australians. We warned, we asked, we begged, We shouted. Every warning was ignored. Antisemitism was normalized on television, in universities, in the arts, in politics, in NGOs, and excused, funded, enabled by those in power. What did you think would happen next? This is no longer incompetence or cowardice. It is now criminal. This cynical anti-Semitic government has blood on its hands. I do not care which political party Prime Minister is part of, whether it's left or right. He failed to do his fundamental job to keep the community safe, and he knew too well this massacre was going to happen. It is a systematic and deliberate purging of Jews from all corners of society by all means necessary, as they promised us for 2 years and shouted this on the streets openly, and nothing was done about it. Do not dare offering more money for security that turns Jewish kindergartens, synagogues and cultural spaces into armed compounds behind bulletproof glass. We will not accept Jewish children growing up behind barricades. If this is the future you tolerate, leave it to yourselves, not us. We demand real safety for Jews in this country. We demand real accountability. We demand mandatory re-education. We demand the removal of anti-Semites from positions of power everywhere. We demand urgent sweeping review of media, universities, art institutions, political parties, NGOs. This country is at breaking point. Confront anti-Semitism now, clearly, forcefully, without excuses, or this is the beginning of the end. Remember this date, December 14th. Remember Matilda's name. Act now. It's enough. Albanese must resign immediately. And that should be just the first step in sweeping changes that are absolutely urgent. Thank you. I'm Nina Sanadze, Goldstone Gallery Director.
Before I go, I'd like to wish all my listeners Chag Sameach for Hanukkah. And I'd like to point out that our Prime Minister Albanese sent out his pro forma Hanukkah greetings just prior to Hanukkah. And this is always expected from political leaders. It came out with the sorts of words one normally expects, but the post on social media was prefaced with Chag Sameach Pesach, which is illustrative of how far off how Prime Minister is in appreciating what our Jewish community is and what it represents. This very embarrassing slip-up was picked up by somebody just before it was corrected on social media. Small flame shows to stay alive. Not many, not loud, not armed, just faith strong enough to survive. A temple broken, hope running thin, one drop of oil, one honest try. And when the night should have ended the light refused to die. Tonight again the world feels torn, names turned into silence and pain. But Hanukkah never looks away, it teaches us where to light the flame. My Osu Yeshuati, my rock, my shelter strong. Lechana El Shabeach, even in sorrow we sing this song. This is the light that carried us then. This is the light that carries us now. As long as we remember their names, the darkness does not win somehow. The candles burn with weight, each flame a prayer, each glow a name. Across the ocean, hearts were broken, innocent lives lost to hate. Hanukkah doesn't deny the grief, it walks straight through the pain. Not with anger, not with fear, but with love. History has shown us. Until next year, it's goodbye from the Israel Connection. Until the end of January, I'll be playing highlights of the Israel Connection from 2025.